Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, October 21st. I'm your reader, Wanda. Here is our first story. Most Iowa felons with newly restored rights haven't registered to vote, but at least 2,550 have joined the state's voting ranks for fall. The voting rights of roughly 35,000 felons in the state who completed their sentences were restored this summer by the executive order, but only 2,550, roughly 7%, of them had registered to vote by mid-October in this fall's election, according to Iowa Secretary of State data. For advocates who have been pressing for the automatic restoration of voting rights for Iowa felons who complete their sentences, that number represents a good start, but shows more work remains. On the one hand, it's great that over 2,550 people have become eligible to vote and have exercised that right by registering, said Mark Stringer, executive director of Iowa Chapter of American Civil Liberties Union. However, Stringer said, that number is also disappointingly low. We will continue to try to elevate this opportunity for folks, Stringer said. Chon Yulmaz of Cedar Rapids said she is one of those 2,550 Iowans who registered to vote after having those rights restored by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' executive order, which automatically restores the voting rights of all felons in Iowa who have completed his or her sentence. Before the order, those individuals were required to petition the governor directly to have their voting rights restored. Iowa was the last state in the nation with that requirement. Yulmaz said she was convicted of a felony in 2002, while living in California. The Iowa native was eligible to vote in California after completing her sentence. She said she voted there in 2016, but could not vote in Iowa when she returned here in 2017. Yulmaz voted early and in person on Tuesday afternoon with a friend. I'm very excited. I can't wait, Yulmaz said Tuesday before she went to vote. When I voted in 2016, I wore that I voted button all around. I never took it off. It's important to me. Betty Andrews, president of Iowa and Nebraska chapters of the NAACP, said stories like Yulmaz are a good start, but only a start. We celebrate that thousands of people are now able to exercise their right to vote and have voice as citizens, Andrews said in an email. 2,550 newly empowered voters in less than a month is an admirable start and could make a difference in an election. We are waiting to see these numbers rise. We're working to see these numbers rise. As advocates said, one potential hurdle to felons registering to vote could be the confusing nature of the issue recently. Reynolds' executive order this summer was the latest tilt of a year-long seesaw in 2005. Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack issued an executive order restoring the voting rights of felons who complete their sentences. But in 2011, Republican Governor Terry Branstad rescinded that. Reynolds, a Republican, and Branstad's lieutenant governor from 2011 to 2017, broke from her predecessor and said she supports the automatic restoration of voting rights for felons who complete their sentences. But instead of issuing another executive order, she spent roughly a year and a half urging state lawmakers to begin the process of amending the Iowa Constitution. Reynolds said she preferred that method because it would be more permanent than an executive order and not subject to the whims of governors. Lawmakers in 2019 and 2020 began the lengthy process of amending the state constitution, but the process stalled when some, state Republicans in particular, wanted to add requirements that felons pay all their court fees and fines before being eligible. After the Iowa legislature failed to reach an agreement on the issue earlier this year, Reynolds switched course, issuing her executive order August 5th. Governor Reynolds will continue to advocate for a constitutional amendment regarding felon voting rights, which would be a permanent solution to this issue, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said in an email. In the meantime, her office will continue to work with local county auditors and the Iowa Secretary of State's office to help any individual looking to navigate this process and vote this year. We also continue to get a lot of positive feedback from individuals who are able to vote this year because of the executive order. Reynolds' order restored the voting rights of roughly 35,000 individuals, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's office. An unknown portion of those could be non-Iowa residents, a spokesman for the office noted. As of mid-October, 2,550 Iowans newly eligible as a result of the governor's order had registered to vote, the Secretary of State's office said. Of those 2,550 newly registered voters, 811 registered as Democrat, 745 as Republican, 53 as Libertarian, 34 as the Green Party, and a plurality, 907, registered with no political party, according to the office. My goal is for every eligible Iowan to register to vote and participate in elections, Secretary of State Paul Pate said in a statement. I agree with Governor Reynolds that Iowans who have served their time deserve a second chance and should be able to make their voices heard by voting. It's going to see more than 2,500 have. It's good to see more than 2,500 have already stepped up and registered since August. A spokesman for the Secretary of State encouraged Iowans interested to visit the restoreyourvote.iowa.gov website for more information. Stringer said the ACLU has similar information available at youcanvoteiowa.org. Next story. Cedar Rapids Council gives initial support for Citizens Police Review Board. Council members laud panel as a first step toward racial equality. The Cedar Rapids City Council enthusiastically advanced plans for a Citizens Police Review Board Tuesday, taking its first step toward making Cedar Rapids more racially equitable. This is only the beginning of the work to be done, several council members said Tuesday, as they gave the green light for the city manager to draft an ordinance outlining the structure of the panel. Mayor Brad Hart said, "This is a sign of so much work that's been done and a big step forward for Cedar Rapids. I really firmly believe that the Cedar Rapids Police Department is one of the very best," Hart said. "Creating the CRB is a proactive step that I hope will build even more trust in our police department so more people will cooperate. That will allow our police officers to solve more crimes, and every one of us will benefit from them. From here, the ordinance will go through a public hearing and the ordinance reading process before the council votes to adopt it. It's sometime in the next 2 months. Once the board receives final council support, it would be among 166 other communities with such boards across the country. And just 5 communities with these panels are also accredited by the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies, which city officials have said would position Cedar Rapids Police Department as a national leader. This is one of 7 demands for police reform put forth by the Advocates for Social Justice after George Floyd's May 25th killing by Minneapolis police that the council unanimously backed June 19th. City staff recommended a review model for the board focused on public engagement, advising the city on police department policies and practices, and reviewing citizens' complaints. Corporate leader Ann Harris Carter, a representative from the Advocates for Social Justice, said during public comment, quote, ASJ made the case at the outset for being at the table, and today we are seeing the results of that approach, unquote. She urged the council to authorize the proposed board to have access to records needed to investigate alleged police misconduct and to recommend disciplinary action based on those findings. If you are still hesitant, then start with the city's published words. The city's goal for establishing a citizens' review board is to establish public safety accountability, bolster confidence in police, increase and improve public cooperation, and make our communities safer for everyone, Carter said. Community Development Director Jennifer Pratt said the review model is the most common activity of citizens' review boards nationwide. It provides an opportunity to review how the policies and procedures are being followed and provide them with insight and to better understand the issues that face law enforcement, as well as building that trust in the process, Pratt said. She said staff have not proposed changes to the process for internal affairs investigation. After that investigation is completed within 60 days, then the police chief would report the results to the review panel. The board members could have a closed session discussion with the police chief using unique identifiers instead of names of officers or witnesses. Correspondence with any discussion about personnel issues would not be made public. In addition to filing complaints about an officer's conduct with the police department, Pratt said city staff proposed expanding this to allow submission to the city clerk's office to avoid real or perceived obstacles to submitting complaints. Council member Dale Todd, who chairs the council's Public Safety and Youth Services Committee, said he sees this as a series of initiatives with more community input to make the effort more fruitful. It was the death of George Floyd that sort of made this conversation come to fruition as quickly as it did across our country, Todd said. This is a good first step. I look forward to more. National events like Floyd's death or the fatal shooting death of Breonna Taylor by Louisville police really shake us, all of us, as said Councilmember Ashley Venori. She said such events make people think what action and oversight can ensure that never happens. It will take generations to undo the systemic racism and institutional racism that has intentionally become a fabric of our everyday, Venori said. Councilmember Scott Overland lauded the step as a marker of leadership and progressivity by city leaders for venturing into territory that none of us would have considered a few years ago. Next story. Iowa City teachers get toolkit to help check lessons for cultural sensitivity. The teachers in the Iowa City Community School District now can check their lessons for cultural responsiveness with a toolkit and submit them to a team of teachers for feedback. The toolkit was created by District Director of Diversity and Cultural Responsiveness, Laura Gray, for teachers to circumvent possible missteps, especially in lessons on race, slavery, and things that are extra sensitive right now in our current climate. The toolkit, however, is not available to the public or to students. Diane Schumacher, the district's Executive Director of Teaching and Learning, said the toolkit is another step in the district's diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives to help teachers check their lesson plans. Data shows the district consistently has gaps in structurally disadvantaged subgroups, students who are Black, Hispanic, English language learners, on free and reduced price lunch, or those with individualized education plans, Schumacher said. We have to have a curriculum that represents our culture and have kids see themselves in our culture and achieving at high levels, no matter their race, demographic, or economic background, Schumacher said. The district is starting to review its social studies curriculum this year and making equity at the forefront of the conversation. Curriculum is reviewed in the district every 8 years. It's certainly an area that has an opportunity to be more culturally responsive than we have been in the past, Schumacher said. The district just wrapped up a review of its language arts curriculum and found it lacked reading material from authors of color. As the district begins purchasing new material for these courses over the next few years, it plans to incorporate more books from authors of color, Schumacher said. One of the documents in the toolkit is a Do's and Don'ts of Teaching Slavery. Last month, a teacher with the district online learning program was put on administrative leave after asking students to pretend to be a black slave for an assignment. The writing prompt said, "Think very, very carefully about what your life would be like as a slave in 1865. You can't read or write, and you have never been off the plantation you work on. What would you do when you hear the news you are free? What factors play into the decisions you make?" Gray said the toolkit will help educators avoid missteps, especially in lessons on race, slavery, and other sensitive topics. "We want to wrap around our teachers at this time to help them understand we believe in them professionally and in their autonomy," Gray said. Gray said in lessons about the history of race in the United States, teachers should allow Black students to feel angry and white students to feel uncomfortable. One of the suggestions in the toolkit is to reach out to Black students and students of color before talking about difficult topics, especially an act of violence such as slavery or lynching. Students can preview it and decide if they want to have that lesson in a different space or with a cohort of Black students, Gray said. "It's important for students to feel safe and build relationships in the classroom. And one way a teacher can accomplish both is by taking their emotional needs into consideration," Gray said. "It's not historically marginalized people's responsibility to educate others," Gray said. "Racial trauma is a real thing, And if we can avoid contributing to some of it, that would be awesome, Grace said. Hancher Online presents new work by jazz musician Wynton Marsalis. Education is always at the intersection of collaborations between trumpet master Wynton Marsalis and Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City. And even though pandemic protocols are moving his latest Hancher concert online beginning Tuesday night, he'll be schooling his virtual viewers on the intersection of jazz and democracy. Jazz music is the perfect metaphor for democracy, he said, in a prelude to a solo video performance of Amazing Grace recorded in the Grand Rotunda of Manhattan's Federal Hall, where the Bill of Rights was approved in September of 1789. We improvise, which is our individual rights and freedoms. We swing, which means we are responsible to nurture the common good with everyone in fine balance. And we play the blues, which means no matter how bad things get, we remain optimistic while still mindful of problems. He's expanding on that concept in a Hancher event that represents first for everyone involved in this musical community conversation. Marsalis chose Hancher for the online debut of his new work, The Sound of Democracy, featuring the Democracy Suite. He and his Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra Septet filmed the concert September 27th in New York's Frederick P. Rose Hill. It's also Hancher's first online pay-to-view presentation as the University of Iowa's performing arts venue looks at new ways to bring the arts to patrons while its doors remain closed. All of this translates to one-of-a-kind experience for audiences, expanding the Hancher reach far beyond Iowa City. This is a new adventure for us, said Chuck Swanson, Hancher's executive director, one that he can share with family, friends, and colleagues around the country, giving them a Hancher experience. The sky's the limit in terms of who can participate. He's honored to bring them a debut performance. First of all, I am very proud to say that this is a collaboration of many presenters around the country, but Jazz at Lincoln Center called Hancher first, Swanson said. He credits the strong ties forged between Marsalis and Jazz at Lincoln Center over 12 previous Hancher appearances. This concert will be lucky number 13. We have a special relationship, Swanson said. What I love about this is that for them, too, this is a new concept because they have not done a lot of virtual and that they have reached out to us first. Hancher has been testing the virtual realms as well, posting local video shorts during the pandemic and hosting the virtual world premiere of Step Africa's Stono dance video in early September. That content has all been free to view, but that's not a sustainable model for Hancher, especially not when it's facing the loss of revenue from canceled or postponed events, as well as the end of the $1.5 million in general support funding from the university within 3 years. We don't want to get out of the routine of charging for performances, Swanson said. So this concert presented an opportunity to ask for a viewing fee of $20 per household to see a video with top-of-the-line production values. What a bargain! $20 for an experience that is special, he said. And even though the video launches at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, the link will be active for 72 hours, so ticket holders can watch at their convenience. Swanson is especially hoping that families with budding musicians will watch it together. He holds many fond memories of Marsalis opening his dressing room door after a concert so he could speak with the line of college and high school students eager to greet him. Then, in December 2013, he didn't want to stop speaking to students between 5 and 8 p.m. holiday concerts in Iowa City's West High School. Realizing Marsalis hadn't even had a chance to eat dinner, Swanson tried to wrap up the discussion, but Marsalis shooed him away. He was enjoying that to the nth degree, Swanson said. He wanted to continue his spirit of teaching to all these kids, so it's from the heart. Another heart project is Democracy Suite, which Marsalis composed during the pandemic. On Hatcher's website, it's described as a response to the political, social, and economic struggles facing our nation. The Democracy Suite is a swinging and stimulating instrumental rumination on the issues that have recently dominated our lives, as well as the beauty that could emerge from a collective effort to create a better future. With the national elections coming in less than 2 weeks, Swanson said the timing is right for the debut. He noted it builds on the concept of thinking about democracy and our freedom and how it's just so important for everyone to have their voice and get things together and end up working together and making things, great things, happen. That's kind of similar to jazz, he said. All these musicians, they're separate instruments. But then finally, in the end, it's all one voice. In his Amazing Grace video, Marsalis continues that line of thinking. The one thing you learn as a jazz musician is how to listen. We don't know what people are going to play, so it's very important for us to follow them. Follow very, very closely. We have a saying, if you want to find something new to play, listen to the person next to you, he said. The question that confronts us right now as a nation is, do we want to find a better way to play? And if we answer affirmative, we will make it through these times. If we answer no, we want to be our worst selves, and we are going to struggle. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First obituary. Robert John Bob Downey, 90, passed away peacefully of natural causes on Monday evening, April 20th, 2020. A private family graveside service will be conducted at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A memorial mass will be held at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, conducted by Father David O'Connor, and a celebration of life will be held at noon Saturday, October 24th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. With his work finished here, Bob is now with his beloved wife, Joanne, looking out for their family from above. While physically separated since Joanne's passing in 2011, she remained ever by his side in his thoughts and actions. Their 8 children referred to them lovingly as RJ and Joni. This held deep meaning to the family, as it represented their closeness. They worked tirelessly side by side their entire lives. Together, they built a highly successful State Farm agency with Joanne as his partner and office manager. Together, they raised, with unconditional love, 8 children: Kathy, husband; Terry, Mo Winkle; Trish, husband Anthony Velustis; Teresa, husband Clark White; Mike, wife Colleen Downey; Don, wife Marilyn Downey; Kurt, wife Deb Downey; John, wife Kathy Downey; and David, wife Wendy Downey, who blessed them with 23 wonderful grandchildren: Ryan, Chad, Jennifer, Brendan, Caleb, Brody, Justice, Austin, Luke, Chloe, Victoria, Zach, Josh, Nick, Mitch, Michael, Kelly, Annie, Joe, Emily, Will, Tom, and his buddy, Jack. They often refer to themselves collectively as the cousins, due to their closeness to one another. He also leaves 12 great-grandchildren. Bob accomplished many things in life. He was an outstanding father, friend, baseball player, coach, and insurance agent. However, nothing compared to his greatest accomplishment, finding the love of his life and the guiding light, Joanne. She was the rock upon which the family was built. He carried on her wish of keeping the family united to one another. We thank God they are united once again. Memorial donations may be made to the American Cancer Society or the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation in honor of Bob and Joanne Downey, care of David Downey at P.O. Box 946 Marion, Iowa 52302. Please share a memory or Bob at www.murdockfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Next obituary: Alan Stanley Big Al Hale, 72, of Ely, Iowa, died Sunday, October 18th, after a brief illness. A visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd, at the Legacy Center at Murdock Linwood in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service with military honors will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, October 23rd, at the Legacy Center at Murdock Linwood. Burial will follow at Wayne Zion Lutheran Cemetery in rural Monticello, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Guests are encouraged to wear casual dress. Al will be wearing his overalls. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home's website tribute page for Al under photos and videos or media, starting at 10:30 a.m. Friday. Al was born March 26, 1948, in Maquoketa, Iowa, the son of Stanley and Lena Siegel Hale. He graduated from Midland High School in Wyoming, Iowa. Al served in the U.S. Army from 1969 to 1971 during the Vietnam War. He was united in marriage to K. Francis Lang on September 2, 1972, in Anamosa, Iowa. Al worked for Square D and then at ADM for more than 30 years, retiring as a foreman. He then worked as a school bus aide for the College Community School District. Al was a member of the Ely American Legion. He enjoyed the Alice Chalmers tractors and classic cars. Al was an outdoorsman who loved fishing, watching, and feeding birds and gardening. He was known for always tinkering around and being a prankster. Al was a fan of the Green Bay Packers. Above all, he was a devoted husband, father, and grandfather. Survivors include his wife, Kay Hale of Ely, children Jennifer, husband John Burrish of Ely, Kristen Hale and Amanda, husband Nick Chase, all of Cedar Rapids. Grandchildren Dylan, wife Haley Brunsheen, Drake Brunsheen, Bryce Burrish, Braden Burrish, Keelan Hale, Heaven McIntosh, and Colin Hale, husband Hunter Hahn. Great-grandchildren, Dawson, Xavier, and Liana. One great-granddaughter, Harper, due in December. Sister Karen Alday of Cedar Rapids. Brother-in-law, Paul, wife Sue Lang of Lisbon, Iowa, as well as four nieces and one nephew. He was preceded in death by his parents, Stanley and Lena Hale. Brother-in-law, Bob Alday, Bill Alday, mother and father-in-law, Paul, wife Kate Lang, Sr., dogs Tasha and Roxy, and several grand pups. Memorials may be directed to the family. The family would like to extend a special thank you to the University of Iowa Hospitals and the VA Hospital for the excellent care they gave Al through the years, especially nurses Justin and Carly, for their love and support in Al's final days. Please share a memory of Al at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Next obituary. Mary T. Morris, 85, of Manchester, passed away peacefully Monday, October 19th, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. She was born August 24th, 1935, the daughter of Albert and Marcella Landecker Durga. Having grown up on a farm herself, it was not surprising she married a farmer. Mary and Robert Morris, Sr., were wed at St. Paul's Catholic Church in Worthington on November 16, 1957. Eight children were born to this union. The couple began their journey on a small farm in the Hiawatha area, only to purchase the Home Place Farm, 3 miles north of Masonville, in 1969. She was a member of Immaculate Conception Church and prayed the rosary faithfully. Mary was the heartbeat of the family. She was a committed, caring, and involved farm wife. She always had a huge garden full of vegetables that led to a very full freezer. Mary was a great cook. Didn't matter if she was cooking for 10 or 20, those meals were memorable. Chicken or fish with cream peas was a favorite. And there was a never-ending dessert of some sort, always on the kitchen counter. Mary found embroidery was a nice way to end her day. She was a die-hard Cubs fan and cheered for the Miami Dolphins. We were blessed with a special person who took time for all. She enjoyed the role of being a mom and truly loved the title of grandma. We are so blessed for all the treasured memories that will last all of us a lifetime. Survivors include her eight children: Kathy, husband Larry Brunsman of Manchester; Bob, wife Susan Morris Jr. of Manchester; Connie, husband Chris Allego of Tacoma, Washington; Karen, husband Scott Bohr of Marion; Mike, wife Beth Morris of Marion; Judy, husband Matt Anderson Morris of Tacoma; Leroy Morris of Cedar Rapids; and Janet, husband Rob Dudley of Winthrop. 16 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, 4 sisters: Alvera Weber of Manchester, Bernice Lansing of Dyersville, Grace Newzel of Dyersville, and Jane Hahn of Dyersville. One brother, John, wife Kathy Durga of Worthington. Two brothers-in-law, Larry, wife Nancy Morris, and William Morris, both of Cedar Rapids. And three sister-in-laws, Mary Jane Overman and Lois Morris, both of Cedar Rapids, and Carol Durga of Racine, Wisconsin. Mary was preceded in death by her husband, Bob, in 2019. Her parents, Albert and Marcella Durga, her parents-in-law, William and Harriet Morris, her brother, Albert Leo Durga, and her brothers-in-law, Richard Morris, Ralph Weber, Art Lansing, Dick Newsill, and Herb Hahn. Because of COVID-19, masks are required at the funeral home and at the church. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonard-muellerfh.com. Prep Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Thursday, October 22nd, at Immaculate Conception Church in Masonville, with the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 21st, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may also call from 8:30 to 9:45 a.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Interment, Oakland Cemetery, Manchester, Iowa. Next, George Kramer, 85, of Hiawatha, passed away Friday, October 16, 2020. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 24th, at First Assembly of God, with visitation starting at 10 a.m. Private burial at Cedar Rapids Memorial Cemetery. George Daniel Kramer was born April 28, 1935, in Neosha, Missouri, the son of Elmer and Myrtle Mayfield Kramer. He attended a country school and then went to Neosha High School, where he played football and ran track. He then continued on to the University of Missouri and lettered in football. George earned a degree in civil engineering. After college, he joined his brothers in Iowa as a partner in the family bridge building business. Some of the major projects included all of the downtown river bridges, including the 5-in-1 dam and the Edgewood Road Bridge. After a lifetime of bridge building, he wintered in Naples, Florida, where he fished with his friends and rode his bicycle. George was united in marriage to Irene Reese on November 21, 1958, in Creston, Iowa. From this union, there were born four children. He was a member of the First Assembly of God Church in Cedar Rapids for 57 years. He was also a member of the Otter Creek Lions Club. Those left to honor George's memory are his wife, Irene, his children, Sherry O'Neill of Spring Hill, Tennessee, Sean Hoskins of Hiawatha, Daniel, wife Teresa Kramer of Grimes, Iowa, and Matthew, wife Robin Kramer of Urbandale, Iowa. Two brothers, Dallas, wife Dolores Kramer of Stockton, Missouri, and Don, wife Janine Kramer of Waukee. 15 grandchildren and 20 great-grandchildren. George was preceded in death by his parents, two sisters, two brothers, a son-in-law, a grandchild, and one great-grandchild. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be sent to First Assembly of God Church, Isaac Newton Christian Academy, or Otter Creek Lions Club. Online condolences may be left at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. A lot of obituaries today. Stephen Patton, 64, died Saturday, October 17, 2020, at Allen Hospital, Waterloo, following an extended illness. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, October 23, 2020, at St. John's Lutheran Church, rural Monticello, where friends may call after noon. Interment will be in the Oakwood Cemetery, Monticello. Pastor Caleb Schway will officiate at the service. Mask must be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times to enter the church. Social distancing needs to be practiced as well. Gochek Funeral Home, Monticello, has taken Stephen and his family into their care. Surviving are two sisters, Linda Patton Marion and Barbara, husband Dennis Mordhorst, Soldier, Iowa. Three nieces, Debbie, wife, a husband Aaron Kress, Jenny, husband Jason Niedermeyer, and Robin Mordhurst. Four great nephews and a great niece. He was preceded in death by his parents, Robert and Ruth Patton. Stephen Robert Patton was born October 28, 1955, at the John McDonald Hospital, Monticello, Iowa. He was the son of Robert and Ruth Koch Patton. He graduated from Monticello Community School with the class of 1974. Steve continued his education at Iowa State University and the University of Iowa and Kirkwood Community College. He was employed in the maintenance department at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Iowa City. Steve later worked at Office Depot. Prior to his many years of illness, Stephen had a great tenor voice, was the student council president, a member of the National Honor Society, and a member of Troop 1683 of the Boy Scouts. He was also a lifelong member of St. John's Lutheran Church. As an irony, he died the exact same day as his father, 27 years apart. Julianne Cecily Sainar, 55, died October 17, 2020. She was born June 14, 1965, to John and Rose Traer Duer of Akron, Ohio. She graduated from Parkersville Catholic High School in West Virginia in 1983 and West Liberty State College in West Virginia in 1988. After college, she moved to Iowa and worked at Iowa's Child Preschool for many years. She was most recently employed by the Iowa City Community School District in nutrition services at Van Allen Elementary. She enjoyed baking, walking, and reading a good book. Julie also loved all of her golden retriever rescues, Shep, Gus, Buddy, Lexi, and Angel. Julie is survived by her husband, Dan, their children, Ryan and Grace, her mother, Rose Duer, in-laws, Ray and Sally Sainar, sisters, Terry, husband, Paul Tigas, Barb, husband, Joe Dickerson, Nancy Wood, Joanne, husband Bill Melville Duer, and Christina, husband Eric Kirkus, brothers David, Joe, wife Meg Duer, Tom, wife Colinda Duer, and John, wife Becky Duer, and many nieces and nephews. Julie was preceded in death by her infant son, Nicholas. Father, John Duer, sister-in-law, Patricia Duer and Tammy Delaney, brother-in-law Brad Wood, niece Jessica Tigas, and nephew Michael Delaney. Please, no flowers, but instead consider memorials to the family for the children, donations to animal shelters, or nature. Per Julie's wishes, there will be a celebration of life at a later date in lieu of formal services. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandshia.com. Frank Snyder passed away Sunday, October 11th, at the Oak Knoll Retirement Residence in Iowa City, Iowa, at the age of 93. Private gravesite services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, October 23rd, at the Sharon Hill Cemetery in Kelowna. Frank's service will be live streamed on Friday afternoon and can be viewed later also. To view, please watch Remembering Frank Snyder on Facebook and request to join the group. For a complete obituary and to share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. Memorial contributions may be made in Frank's memory to the Employee Gratuity Fund in care of Oak Knoll Retirement Residence in appreciation of the fine, wonderful, hardworking COVID heroes responsible for Frank and Gretchen's loving care and compassion shown while in residence. Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service is caring for Frank's family and his service. Kieran Ken Hyken, 82, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Monday, October 19, 2020, of pancreatic cancer at his home, interment at Linwood Cemetery in Mausoleum, will take place at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted the family. He was born October 14, 1938, in Monticello, Iowa, the son of Rex and Gladys Postel Hyken. He graduated from Anamosa High School and studied electronics at DeVry Institute of Technology. Ken served his country in the U.S. Army. He was united in marriage to Georgia Ruth Garvey on November 2, 1968, at Zion Lutheran Church in Iowa City. Ken worked at IBM, Defense Logistics Agency, and owned and operated Hyken Electronics for 14 years. He loved doing mechanical work on cars and tractors. He went on tractorcades and belonged to the Tractor Club. Ken will be missed by all who knew and loved him. Those left to cherish his memory include his wife, Ruth, of Cedar Rapids, children, Dawn, husband, Pat, Waters, of Burlington, Blake Hyken, of Cedar Rapids, Sean, wife, Diane Hyken, of Norway, Iowa, Daniel, wife, Darcy Hyken, of Cedar Rapids, 9 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, siblings, Kent, wife, Marcia Hyken, of Cedar Rapids, and Kay, husband Marv Johnston of Texas, and father-in-law John Knowlton of Cedar Rapids. Ken was preceded in death by his parents, his mother-in-law Viola Knowlton. Please share a memory of Ken at www.murdochfuneralhome under obituaries. Kevin D. Scherfany departed unexpectedly Wednesday, October 14th, born August 9th, 1958, to Sheila and Charles L. Scherfany. They preceded him in death. His cherished wife of 42 years, Melba Mel Scherfany, survives him along with numerous friends and family he cherished knowing. He was a brave, kind, generous, and grateful man of sincere faith who brought joy and laughter. Remember Kevin in memorials at the UIHC Holden Clinical Cancer Center, BCAN, and Samaritan's Purse Operation Christmas Child. Special thanks to Cedar Rapids Police, Mercy Hospital, and Emergency Services. Services, private services with entombment following at Cedar Memorial Park Mausoleum, public visitation 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time. Face masks are required at the visitation and funeral. View the live stream for this service at client.tribucast.com/TCID/14783157 beginning at 1 p.m. Friday, October 23rd. Online condolences are welcome at www.cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.